Coming up, a special with Nick Skinner and Bertus de Jong as they talk all the way through the League 2 Tri-Series in Nepal, with Bertus travelling there for the first time. It sounds like it won't be the last either. Enjoy, plenty of good stuff coming up on Emerging Cricket. We'll wrap the Challenge League playoff as well as all the other action around the Emerging Cricket world, so make sure to follow us wherever you are on social media platforms as well as your podcast arenas and emergingcricket.com. But for now, here's Nick with Bertus.
Well, it's a warm welcome back to a long-time friend of the show, Bertus de Jong, Dutch cricket journalist extraordinaire, writing for CricBuzz these days. Recently in Nepal, recently being just landed a few hours ago home, looking at Nepal, the Netherlands and Namibia playing a tri-series both in the ODI and T20 format. The ODI matches being part of the just-started League 2, and the T20 matches being, I guess, a kind of, you could see them as a warm-up for the upcoming World Cup, but we'll get into that. Welcome, Bertus.
Yeah, good evening, Nick, and namaste, everyone. Great to be back on the pod again.
Yes, namaste indeed. This is your first time to Nepal, and from what I've heard, you're a bit of a convert to the Nepal train.
Yeah, absolutely huge fan. I can't believe I've never been before. I can't wait to get back.
Yeah, it's definitely on the bucket list for seeing some cricket in Nepal. The Rasmus called them the India of associate cricket, just in terms of the, you know, the passion and the crowds, and I think that seems pretty accurate. You were there. You did some commentary as well with our good friend Andrew Leonard. You were watching all the games. Just give us your sense, kind of as a bit of an overview of the series. We'll start with League 2 and the ODIs. Namibia won 3 matches, Netherlands won 2, and Nepal, the home side, after being on a, I think, 15-match winning streak at home, they only won 1 match.
Yeah, somewhat unexpected. Namibia obviously struggled on the last tour to Nepal. The Netherlands dropping back from the Super League, at least on paper, you'd have expected them to be favourites coming into this competition. And yeah, Nepal at home, like something of a reversal. But, you know, a year's a long time in associates cricket, and you see how these things can turn around. Namibia certainly came with a plan. 3 win, yeah, they take 6 points back home with them. They'll be fairly pleased, at least, with how the ODIs went for the Dutch. Well, it's fair to say there's no question that they were treating the competition lightly. I think they were probably aware of the fact that they were going to be targeted as the team to beat in this competition. And it's quite difficult to hit the grounds running. It's a very different sort of cricket from what they've been playing for the last few years. Somewhat different, new look squad. Not that that's a new problem for them. They're often chopping and changing with availability issues and the like. But yeah, perhaps not the exact scoreline that many of us would have expected at the start of the series, but not entirely unsurprising either. I don't think anyone was shocked. We knew, I think, looking at this cycle of League 2 ahead of time, that it was going to be pretty cutthroat, and it was really hard to pick really even a top 4, bottom 4 ahead of time. And I think, yeah, the way that we've seen this series play out, and I think the way that we're seeing this current ongoing series in the UAE playing out as well, that at least in our predictions of unpredictability have been borne out.
Yes, I mean, that's just what happens with you. You know, you have a lot of very closely matched teams. Put them all together in a league, and you're going to get a lot of close games. We had a couple of thumpings. The first Netherlands and Nepal match, the second Netherlands and Nepal match, actually both of their games, 2 different results, but both of them won by very comfortable margins. But then, you know, there was that absolute classic between Namibia and Nepal. Namibia getting over the line by 2 wickets. And, you know, even in their first match, Namibia had to work hard. 4 wicket win against Nepal. And yeah, I mean, there was a lot of very tense cricket, very tight cricket. It was scrappy, I think would probably be a fair way of describing it. You know, you had a lot of kind of contributions. People kept getting out. No one looked really set with the bat. And yeah, especially the spin bowlers across all 3 teams were the real threat. I mean, Erasmus taking 12 wickets for Namibia, you know, leading wicket taker of the series. Arjen Dutt with 11 for the Netherlands, and the sort of flotilla of spin options for Nepal all chipping in. On the other hand, the seam bowling attacks from all 3 teams, other than Viv Kingma, who I think bowled very well in, you know, not particularly friendly conditions, they were all sort of lacking penetration. So I don't know, because then you look across at the T20 series and it was just run fests. So were they using a different strip, the square? I'm not sure what was going on with that, because it doesn't, like, it's a big gap between the League Two kind of deck and the T20s.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Lots to process there. Let's try and do it in reverse order. Yeah. I think the disparity, I was quite taken aback, of course, by the disparity of the run scoring between the T20Is and the ODIs to start. They were using, it's the same square at the end of the day. All the games are at TU. So the first, answer you kind of give is just perhaps it's a question of intent. You know, it is. You know, you could take a lot more risks over 20 overs. You've got 10 wickets to play with in both scenarios. So I think perhaps what the T20 showed is that a bit more attacking intent in the ODIs might have borne fruit. But what you can't ignore, of course, is that there were very, very early starts in the ODIs. There were 9:30 games. It was still very chilly, very damp in the mornings. So those, and I think if you look at the ODIs, you saw that the best time to bat was pretty much the back end of the first innings. And the first bit of the second, which is functionally about the same time of day that the T20Is were happening. The T20Is were 11:30 starts, which the rationale there was, I was a bit surprised that they weren't doing them in sort of the afternoon so that you might catch some of the post-work crowds. But the rationale, I think, was because the square had seen so much cricket over it, not just the ODIs, but of course the Canada series before that, and the PM Cup, the domestic one-day competition in Nepal, had run almost up to that Canada series. So the square had seen an awful lot of cricket. So I think the rationale for playing those T20s as much sort of in the middle of the day as possible was to provide the best possible batting conditions. And that worked clearly in the T20s. And yeah, the ODIs, those early morning starts, I think, it's not just that there was still a bit more sort of damp in the strip, and you know, cold, you know, the cold and the overhead conditions. But I think it played a little bit with the players' minds as well. That feeling that you couldn't really go in the power play, and that you saw those early wickets that were kind of creating panic through the middle order. That was sort of a repeated theme, that those innings never really got going. That the bowling side, you saw, I don't think anyone chose to bat first throughout the entirety of the ODI series. We had a couple in the T20s where we had captains winning the toss and batting first. But as I recall, all of the ODIs, you had teams winning the toss and bowling first, and only one occasion where anyone managed to post 200. When they did, they defended it. So, yeah, the toss played a big role in that. The early morning starts played a big role in that. But also, I think that some of it was, to an extent, yes, psychological, and just the sort of thing that early wickets can do to an ODI innings. And let's not forget, I think you've done good work on this in the past, that blowouts are the norm in cricket. And when a team gets on top, they normally stay there. So, yeah, what we've seen is not an enormous amount of close games in the ODI series, but a very back and forth series. I didn't see any team lose two consecutive matches. Namibia were the only ones that managed to win two consecutive matches. I'm just checking my notes here, but I think that's right. So, yeah, and three evenly matched teams, toss having a big impact, partly in conditions, due to the conditions, partly the psychology of it. And the fact that, I mean, nobody managed to bat their 50 overs. Nobody even managed to get close to batting 50 overs, batting first. So that when you have that, especially when the best batting conditions are in the middle of the day, if you're not batting your 50 overs, you're not only losing your best 10 overs to bat, you're also handing 10 of the best overs of the day to bat to the opposition. So really what you think is just how impressive it is from Namibia in that fifth ODI against the Netherlands. Specifically, I think that partnership between, just from memory, sorry, it was Jan Nicolofsky-Eaton and Jan Frielink, I think, that got them up to that 200. And then, yeah, that one time someone managed to get past 200 in the ODIs, they defended it, perhaps not comfortably, but pretty convincingly. So I think that's really the point of difference between the three teams. If you look at the scoreline, is really that one game where Namibia really showed that you can fight your way to a 200 target, that those games are winnable batting first. And they managed to do that once. And, you know, they win it and they run out as table leaders by the end of the series. So I think that's more or less the story of that ODI series. Just, yeah, Namibia coming with a plan. Winning, you know, that one game where you lose the toss and have to bat first. And yeah, that's that's really what's put them ahead of the field, or at least they were ahead of the field up until this ongoing series. Of course, I think they've been pit by your boys, Canada now.
Well, yes, I'm sure I'll get to that Canada series and analyzing their four victories in great detail. But for now, we'll stick to the tri series in Nepal, and I guess going through the teams, I get maybe in order of how happy they are with the results. We can start with Namibia. I mean, one big kind of takeaway for me is that Erasmus is actually good with his off spin now. It had kind of been, I don't want to say his bowling was a joke, but he was certainly pretty self-deprecating. He referred to it as filthy off spin. I think it was kind of a play that bring on a guy who's not taken too seriously, and sometimes the batters take their foot off the pedal and don't concentrate. And that was maybe how he was taking his wickets. But he was bowling proper off spin, and I assume the pitch probably helped in that regard. But top wicket taker of the series. That's nothing to sniff at. Able support from Bernard Schultz with Misley as always. Just impossible to get away in helpful conditions. I mean, you referred to the fact that Namibia struggled in their last visit to Nepal. Historically, Namibia's away record has been quite bad, but somehow they've put it together, and this bodes well, I guess, for the rest of League Two. Obviously, there's a long way to go, but just from looking at it, I guess, from a distance, it seems to me that the experience of this team, Erasmus has come along with the ball. They're all just a bit better. They've got the experience. They've played in Nepal before, so maybe the screaming crowd and the kind of experience of being in Nepal, it's not overwhelming in the same way as it might have been, last time they were here.
Gary Erasmus is filthy off spin. I've teased him with that self description a couple of times in the post matches after he's walked in with a bag of wickets to his name again. 12 wickets in the series, an average of I think barely 10. Economy I think well under four and over. It's he's a frontline bowler, which he has finally admitted under duress perhaps. But yes, his off spin's impressed. It really has. It's there's a new dimension to it. I think it's been remarked repeatedly in the commentary that he's been pulling the Mark Watt bowling from well behind the crease. But it's not just that. The accuracy has been there, and that's I think above all what's helped him. That, and of course the fact that he's often been bowling either in tandem or following up from Bernard Schultz, who only took 6 wickets in the ODI series, but was just phenomenal in terms of putting the pressure on. His economy is probably, I think, about 2.5 and over, or maybe a little more than that, but not much more. And bowling 40 odd overs across the series, and I think possibly not even giving away 100 runs from those, maybe exactly 100 runs, that's going to put an enormous amount of pressure to score off the other end. And whether Erasmus is still seen as a part-timer that you can target by the opposition at the start of the series, they certainly weren't by the end. So you've seen that spin that played a role throughout, especially in the ODIs. But yeah, the way that Erasmus has been able to step up as a frontline bowler, almost a bowling all-rounder in this series, and I think only actually a somewhat disappointing series with the bat, only averaged about 20, 21, 22 maybe. But in terms of the balance of the Namibia side, or at least the flexibility of the Namibia side, that's helped enormously. And his influence on the team, you can see that they have that the way they sort of fell away a bit in the T20s in his absence. I think he had to fly home with a side strain or some sort of side injury. But the way that they fell away in the T20 series, you kind of think that's partly his influence, and partly I think just long tours are still tough for the Namibia guys. As you rightly say, they've struggled away from home in the past, and they've certainly improved in that regard. But you did still see, I think, if you played the T20s and the ODIs the other way around, it might have been a different story. But as it was, yeah, the fact that they came, yeah, with plans in place, and knowing how they wanted to go about this ODI series, and yeah, the results speak for themselves.
I think you mentioned the balance or the flexibility of the Namibian team. Probably the biggest question mark from this performance is I guess some team composition questions in, JJ Smith didn't bowl a single over. Jan Frielink only bowled a little bit, although he was quite successful in the little, the little period that he did bowl. I'm just thinking, are they both now considered batting all-rounders, or, is Frielink injured and he'll get back to bowling more later, or is JJ still nursing that injury that kept him out for a while? Because, I'm just looking at the way the team kind of balances out. You can get away with one of them doing that, but if I don't think that Smith and Frielink are both good enough batters to not be contributing with the ball. And I mean, Frielink especially, I think he looks a bit out of his depth as a top order bat. And yeah, so if he's not going to bowl, it makes more sense to play another bat instead.
Yeah, I think there's you can make that case. Frielink, he did bowl a bit more in the T20Is, of course, and yeah, occasionally as in the ODIs. But you notice that what the sort of bowling that he brings, the option that he brings, is it's different from the other seamers. In fact, he's almost barely really a seamer in the way that he's bowling at the minute. He was almost bowling sort of fast left arm spin, like the cutters coming through so slowly that you almost regard him as a fast spinner,
Well,
but
I
it
mean,
has
I think that kind of bowling is very effective on this sort of pitch, which is why I was a bit puzzled that he wasn't bowling more.
to. Yeah, I think there's actually a case that you can make that he was underused as a bowler. There's a question of whether to the extent to which the sort of this change in approach from him with the ball is enforced. He's obviously not getting any younger, but I think that the role for him as a batting all rounder, I think I think it's underrated the extent to which he's come along as a bat. He didn't have the greatest ODI series, admittedly, a couple of 30s and not much more. But he made runs in the T20Is, and I think that the argument you make, I think the idea is that once if you have JJ back bowling, and my understanding is that long term the hope is to rehabilitate JJ as a bowler rather than a sort of specialist, a specialist finisher. Although specialist finisher again is an underrated role and it's one that he performs very well. But I think looking ahead, team balance, what the way that Namibia I think are looking at building this squad is to be able to construct the playing 11 on the day with the greatest flexibility that they can, and that's why they're looking to have Frielink settle in as a top order bat, whilst retaining the flexibility to bring him down the order. And you'll notice that the same Green has been coming in very low, but that doesn't seem to be a hard and fast rule for them. He has come up the order when the situation required. So yeah, I mean, looking ahead with the fitness questions is, the balance of the team changes whenever anyone gets injured in this Namibia side, just because their roles are also remarkably sort of unique. I wouldn't call them bits and pieces players exactly, but they're not, there's even if you're looking at, guys like Lofty Eaton or Lunamain, who's almost a specialist bowl the worst overs that nobody else wants to bowler. They're quite unique the way that the team fits together. And I think that developing these secondary skills, and that's something that the Netherlands have clearly been using this tour to do as well, gives you that option to put teams together in a more flexible way, depending on, say, the conditions, the opposition, the matchups, and also to be more resilient to kind of enforce changes due to injury and unavailability. I think that over the course of this League Two series, you're going to see, obviously, inevitably, all of the teams will be affected by injuries, by unavailabilities, and the like. And I think that building that sort of squad depth and that squad flexibility is something that's probably going to be quite decisive in this tournament.
Yeah, the Namibian approach of being very flexible and having so many players who contribute with both disciplines, it kind of reminds me of PNG, but they're just a bit better. They have a whole bunch of all-rounders, but they can actually push through with either discipline. I guess another guy who, I guess he's come into the team as a bowler and does a fair bit of batting is Ruben Trompelman. And did you think he was looking a bit sort of a bit quiet? He lacked a bit of bite. He just was kind of ineffective, and I know that the track probably wasn't helping. And then in the T20s it was a high scoring series, but yeah, he was pretty anonymous for them, and usually he's kind of the spearhead.
Yeah, he wasn't at his best. That's probably fair. I think he'd quite happily admit that himself. My understanding is that he wasn't that he was coming back essentially. I'd actually heard that the first time that he'd only bowled off a full run up, I think a day or two before the first ODI, So he's not quite, my understanding is he's not quite at peak fitness at the minute. I'm not sure exactly what the nature of the injury or the niggle is that he's carrying. But yeah, it should be said that barring Viv Kingma, almost all the seamers were pretty anonymous in the ODI series. And it's somewhat surprising, I guess, because you'd have thought that there'd be some helpful conditions, certainly in that opening power play in the morning, and something that really only Kingma managed to take consistent advantage of. But yes, I think Troppenmann has a bit of a pars pro toto of all the seamers for all three sides, with the exception of Kingma, didn't really come into the series until, strange enough, until the T20Is, when Seam started getting back into the game. But Troppenmann's specific case, my understanding is it's probably not best. He didn't have his best tour, that's fair, but it's probably not fair to judge him on his tour either, because as I understand it, he was coming back from injury or fitness issue just ahead of the tour. So I don't think Namibia will be too worried about that.
Okay, and you brought up Viv Kingma, and as we said, he bowled very well in conditions that maybe weren't as favourable for seamers. Although, you refer to the kind of damp conditions in the start of the day. A good seamer often can exploit that. So yeah, I thought Kingma was very impressive, and the Netherlands, I guess more generally, two wins, two losses. That's probably enough to say that's a pass mark. But looking around at the team, they could definitely have done a lot better, especially in the one day games. The bowling, I don't know. I mean, Ayan Dutt was very good, and Kingma was very good, but the sort of supporting cast, I think, we're letting them down a bit.
Yeah, I think C minus, I think, is probably what you call two wins from four. I think a C minus is probably the grade that you'd have to give the Dutch. But it's, as I say, it's the first series back. It's a very different sort of cricket. And in terms of the bowling, well, if you look at, it was a broadly similar team to the World Cup in terms of the squad, but it wasn't really in terms of who was shouldering bowling duties. I think three of the four bowlers that the most overs for them in the World Cup. So, sorry, two of the four, in Paul van Meegeren and Logan van Beek, were absent, of course. The Dutch didn't try and bring in anyone who had domestic commitments in the Southern Hemisphere or in the Windies, in the case of Daniel Doram. They didn't chase hard to get those guys released for the series, which I think is probably the right call. Paul van Meegeren, of course, was on in the squad initially, but was rather ambushed by the arrival of his first child, so congratulations to him. But quite
Yeah.
rightly prioritised that over the tour. But of the four bowlers, yeah, Arjan was quite prominent in this ODI series for the Dutch, and Bas really took a back seat, Bas de Leyde, that is. So the bowling attack was rather different from what we'd seen for the Dutch, sort of in the run up to the series. It should also be noted that in the run-up to this series, what they've actually been doing is practicing T20Is, because it's very clear that their priority at the moment is the T20 World Cup. And that's not to say that they're not taking League Two seriously, but they're very much a T20 focused team at the moment. That refocus after the 50-over World Cup, as you see it in the fixtures that they've been setting up for themselves, and the fact that this is a competition where really it's top four is all that matters, I think, does mean that you can afford a kind of a slow start. As favourites, and not spend too much time worrying about it, with a T20 World Cup coming up. But yeah, and in this series, yeah, again, a spin heavy series, and the guys that have shouldered most of the burden have been Arjan and Viv, and they've done well. And in terms of supporting cast, I think there was a degree of intention to experiment. You saw sort of SA Engelbrecht bowling a few overs, more in the T20Is than the ODIs, but bowling a few overs of off spin. Michael Levitt bowling, I think, again, a handful of overs in the ODIs, but then far more prominent with the ball in the T20s. And I think there was an extent to which the Dutch are trying to work towards a situation where, again, you have these guys with secondary skills that allows you more flexibility in selection. And to an extent, I think this tour was intended to work towards that as well.
Well, I mean, just on that secondary skill situation, Max O'Dowd actually hasn't bowled a whole lot recently.
Barely bowls in club cricket.
When he first started with the Netherlands, he did sort of roll the arm over every now and then as a kind of a part-timer, but that seems to have fallen really by the wayside.
Yeah, I think it's something that I did speak to Scotty about this, to Scott Edwards about this at the presser. I was a little surprised to see Max turning his arm over again. It's usually very situational, but I gather it is something he's been working on in the net. And because the Dutch, I think, will they want to be able to go with essentially a part-time, an adequate part-time leg spinner. There's three, I guess, wrist spinners in contention for the Dutch, and of the three, none of them are guaranteed of place in the starting 11 at this point. So Shahriz Ahmed had a very tough tour, I think, really, broadly speaking. Had leg break googly bowler, of course, and you have Flip Wasserveen, who's more of a conventional leg spinner, as currently, I think, also in New Zealand, working to break into the, I think, the Canterbury setup. And then Saqib Zulfikar, but none of those three, I think, are sort of guaranteed first choice picks for the Dutch. So they're going to find themselves in a situation where they're going to be, where their first choice 11 doesn't include any leg spinners other than arguably Max O'Dowd. So I think that is, again, something that they've been working on to have that option. It's probably at this stage far from an ideal option still. As with almost all part-time leg spinners, you're going to get a boundary ball and over from Max, two if you're lucky. So, yeah, I think it's something that they're clearly looking to develop as a skill from him. And I think having a secondary skill, Max has actually struggled a little bit with the bat. You know, after such an incredible start to his career, he to an extent, you wonder if that's a return to the mean. But he's looked rather out of sorts this tour. So yeah, at least from his personal perspective as well, having a second string to his bow might be quite handy, especially with all these young openers pushing for his position. And that is, I don't imagine that Max O'Dowd is getting dropped anytime soon from this Dutch squad. The class that he's shown in the past certainly insulates him. But I think, yeah, having the ability to bowl a couple of overs of leg spin probably help him down the line, holding off the young guns snapping at his heels.
Well, yeah, I just on that point, I've got a note here of, O'Dowd being quite anonymous at the top of the order, well, in both formats. And, it's been a while since you could really say he's in good form. He has been kind of, I don't know, just kind of putting in some pretty mediocre performances for a little while, which is probably a cause for concern. And, you mentioned the young openers. Vikramjit Singh comes over, plays one match, hits an unbeaten half century. It does kind of make you wonder why Singh was only playing one game, what that was about. And is Levitt the long-term option going forward, partnering O'Dowd at the top of the order? Is Vikramjit coming in at number three now? Or, so how does that all fit together? Because, you'd think Levitt, I guess looking a little bit ahead to the T20 series, he seems to have nailed down his spot in that format, but I'm a bit less convinced in the 50 over stuff.
Again, I think it's healthy to have competition for every spot in the team, really. So talking about Max's form, look, yeah, he looked a bit out of sorts this series, but it should be said that even though he looked out of sorts, he's still the fourth highest run scorer for the Dutch, I think. Or sorry, behind. Sorry, fourth highest in the averages. I think there's a very good chance he made the most runs over the course of this.
Well, no, that's what I mean.
Over the course of the ODIs,
He hasn't been terrible. He's just been kind of,
just sort of there.
there. Yeah, well, exactly.
I think that's just sort of just there. Yeah, I think that's pretty much a decent summary of Max's tour. Just he's been there. Yeah, I think it's worth noting that even when, and he has looked, to be honest, like he's been struggling. And I think it is, you've got to say, it's actually the sign of a pretty class player that if you can look like you're at your worst and still somehow be making more runs than everyone else. So you've got to give him some kind of credit for that. But I think, yeah, again, the competition for spots is healthy. I didn't like that they weren't playing Vikram. I think, and no one would have been surprised to hear that, not just because I think that Vikram's a huge talent, but I also just, you've got no left-handers. Everyone's bowling left-arm spin at you. But I thought it was genuinely surprising that you're taking your only left-handed bat and leaving him on the bench for all but one game. And then he plays that game, he makes 58 not out, and then he's on the bench again after that. But again, I'm not, we're not anywhere near the point at this stage that I'm going to be second-guessing these sort of selection decisions or pressing too hard on that. At the end of the day, this is, you have to have a bit of faith in the coaching and selection staff. There's questions to be asked, certainly, about whether these selections are, firstly, whether you're really necessarily trying to get your best 11 on the field to win every game, or whether you're actually building towards sort of squad depth and finding out. And I don't think that that's also an entirely legitimate approach for what aren't every series in Associates cricket is crucial, but these, you know, some are less crucial than others. I don't think it's unreasonable to be looking to be building squad depth and experimenting a little bit in series like these, especially the T20Is, which, you know, to an extent is pretty much the point of having these trilaterals in the lead up to the World Cup. So I'm not going to be too quick to second guess selection decisions. I'd have liked to see the play a few more games, but again, look, you know, Levitt was finding his way at the top in the ODIs. Then you saw in the T20Is in what was his debut series, he went out and hit almost 250 runs. So yeah, again, I'm not going to be laying into it to Ryan Cook and the brains trust there too much. You found a third opener. Vikram looks like he can bat three as well. I wouldn't mind just seeing them experiment and having Vikram and Levitt open and Max at three. I think broadly speaking, yeah, having a bevy of top order bats who can open but don't have to only adds to the depth and the flexibility of the squad.
And I mean, I guess having a bevy of top order bats, I mean, Nepal, their top order was okay, but you know, below that, there was just sort of nothing after the top slash middle order. That was kind of the weak point of the Nepal's campaign, and you know, it was disappointing that they lost three and only won one. They thrashed Netherlands in the first match, and you know, they looked very convincing in that game. And then you know, where did that go? They really sort of tailed off. You know, young prodigy Anil Shah, who looked really good in that first game, bashing the Netherlands around. I think it went at a strike rate of 130 odd, just absolutely caned them. You know, admittedly a small chase, but then you know he kind of tailed off in his form. You know, Asif Sheikh was good at the top, but then yeah, didn't have a whole lot of support. So yeah, I'm not sure what happened with Nepal here, because you know, you look back to that run of victories at home, it was built on a strong batting order. And I know that in a historical context, you know, you don't really associate Nepal with a strong batting lineup, but in that sort of you know, the last kind of 12, 18 months, their batting has been probably more of their strong point, and their bowling has been the weak link for Nepal's performances. And here it's kind of, yeah, the batting is, I don't know if it's reverting to the mean or if, you know, they've just had a bad series, but yeah, they looked pretty disappointing.
Well, I mean, they won't be too pleased, but look, you know, Nepal, they lost three games. They also, let's be fair, they also lost three tosses. The only side in this entire series that have managed to win one against the toss were Namibia. And the fact that they did that has been the difference. Nepal, look, they showed against, you know, their win against the Netherlands in the second ODI was almost a direct reversal of their loss against Namibia in the opening one. And really, I think was just a almost encapsulated the series. What happens if you win the toss and make really good use of that? And Namibia did that to them in the opening game, and they did it to the Netherlands in the next. You know, it absolutely was not a win toss, win the match series, but it was like, once if you do win the toss, if you can make use of it, if you make use of it, if you don't make any mistakes, if you know, then bowl and bat well, you're going to get a blowout. You're not just going to win, you're going to win convincingly. And Nepal showed in that second game, you said, like Anil Shah, he's, you know, got oodles of talent, but he also had the best time of day to bat, along with Bertel in that game, and chasing 137. And when it got tougher, it was tougher. So there was a great deal of hand-wringing here about, oh, Nepal has forgotten how to bat or the like. Well, I don't think that's really fair. I think that actually, if you look at the times that Nepal lost the toss and lost the game, they were the team that pushed the opponents closest. For example, in that match that, you know, Namibia only got over the line by 2 wickets, thanks to Khairul Azam's 50. I think that you can argue that, yes, of course, it's a home series. You've got one from four. This has not gone well. That's certainly true. But I don't think it's time to start throwing out the entire process, to start making wholesale changes or losing faith with the way that Nepal have gone about their cricket.
No, definitely not.
This is, yeah, it's not, of course, the series hasn't gone, certainly the ODI series hasn't gone the way they would have hoped. But there's, you know, there's positives to be taken from it. Not least, yeah, Asif Sheikh, who I think was excellent through the series, through the ODI series. Kushal Patel's leg spin, which, as part-time leggies go, he's ahead of Max O'Dowd at this point in my book. Likewise, Rohit's bowling. I think that this, yeah, it's not a great, it's not the results that they've been getting at the back end of the last League Two, but I still think that this looks like a stronger, like an Nepal side that's getting stronger. You're always going to get a reversion to the mean after a run like that. Nepal, looked at the back end of the last League Two like they were the best associate side by a country mile, but they're not. We know they're not. So the results are not going to keep, if you have an extraordinary run of results, it's exactly that. It's extraordinary. You shouldn't expect it to continue. It doesn't mean that the long-term trajectory of the side is not still trending up. But this was, that run at the end of the last League Two with the momentum with them and the crowds behind them and all the opposition kind of falling apart in front of them. That's not something that you should expect to continue because, again, an extraordinary run is an extraordinary run. So expect the results after it to be worse.
Yeah, I mean that's fair enough, and yeah, I definitely agree that Nepal is still one of the most exciting young batting sides. Just tons of guys in their early to mid 20s who still have a bit of upside and can still get better, and they're already performing at a good level. Anil Shah is just sort of the most recent in a long line of those. Looking across to the bowling though, it's probably more of a cause for concern, really. The spin all rounders in Mallah and Iree were kind of anonymous. Rajpanch in Bertel, who you mentioned, bowled well, carrying kind of the spin load. But the seamers, yes, again, the conditions not very favourable. But Karan KC with 0 wickets, and Sompal Kami with, I think he took 3 or 4 across the series. Kami, to be fair, was tidy, so I don't think he bowled badly, but he certainly wasn't getting much much incision through the batting lineups.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that's fair. Like Rajbanshi bowled extremely well throughout the ODI series, as I think actually, though his figures don't really show it, did Kushal Mallah and DS, I thought, tidily as well, and they obviously found their reward in the end, far more in the T20 ice than in the ODIs. And likewise, Sampal, I think if you saw some of his early spells, was a little unlucky not to get more wickets than he did. But yeah, out and out, this was always going to be a very difficult series, I think, in the conditions for the sort of bowler that he is. But yes, I think like seam options going forward
Well, yeah, who's the next cab of
is
the
a
rank?
genuine long term concern for Nepal. I don't think that any of the younger seamers really looked like they were likely to be able to shoulder, the responsibility that Kami and Karan KC have carried for Nepal over the better part of a decade now. Yeah, I think that if you're looking at a long-term concern, I think that seam bowling is probably it. Though, as you say, like all of the seamers for all three sides, with the exception of Kingma, had a pretty tough time of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, as we look to the T20 Tri Series, and as you said, the seam bowlers came back into it a little bit, but it was very much a run fest, and none of the bowlers had a particularly good time of things. I am interested in your thoughts regarding, all three of these teams kind of tinkering a bit with their lineup. Nepal probably looked the most settled. I think T20 is their best format at the moment. The Netherlands have apparently discovered a run machine in Levitt at the top of the order, and Namibia, fiddling around a bit. They often, in a lot of these series, they give the impression that they don't really care and that they're just sort of playing around. It's sort of more of a net session. Hard to necessarily read a lot into it, but out of the three teams, I'm very interested to see how they all play at the upcoming World Cup. Nepal especially look very dynamic, and they can probably beat, I think, anyone in their group if they have a good day. I mean, where do you see all these three teams performing in a few months' time in the US and the Caribbean?
Well, yeah, that's. I guess that was the big question of the that was the big question of the series, isn't it? And very much the point of it. I say that, yeah. I mean, look, taking Namibia first, you say it looks like they don't really care. I think it is just that it's a very long tour. I think that there was something of the highs of coming off that ODI series where they've basically almost got that feeling of mission accomplished. It's tough, and then your captain's forced to go home. I think it's tough to keep that level of intensity up over T20 series. There is, I mean, look, everybody wants to win the series, but at the end of the day, it's not pretend that it's not functionally a warm-up series for the World Cup for all three teams, because that's what it is. So, and even then, Namibia, they were in with a shot at the final right up until their last game. So it's not as if they kind of threw their toys and just sort of phoned it in. Certainly, a few individual standouts, not least the fastest T20i century from Nico Lofty-Eaton. I think a couple of the fringe guys, I think Malin Kruger had a great had a pretty decent showing as well. Bench Congo was maybe didn't pick up an enormous amount of wickets, but he certainly wasn't going for many runs either. So in terms of sort of seamers coming back into it, he really stood out for me, and it didn't really get much of a chance in the ODIs. So in terms of how
Yeah,
these three guys are shaping
Shikongo
up.
had the best economy rate of any Namibian bowler by some distance, even
Yeah,
with going
of any
first.
seamer and any seamer that wasn't Kingma, who we should just talk about a bit more, because what an incredible tour he had, by the way. We touched on it just now that he was bowling well and looking good, and that he was the seamer with the most success in the ODIs. In the T20Is, he was going at less than a run a ball. Absolute just machine opening the bowling in that power play, but also sort of coming back, and the way that his old ball bowling has really come into its own this series has impressed me enormously. And I've actually gone so far as to dig up his stats here for the T20I series. It's 19 overs for 107 runs, 6 wickets, and an economy of 5.63
Andy.
for a seamer in a T20I, in a high scoring T20I series. I mean, that's just extraordinary, really.
Well, the next best is 8.1 from Roelof Vandermeer. So, yeah, very, very handy indeed.
Yeah, sorry, just sit back for a moment and admire what an excellent series, what an excellent tour Vivian King has had. But we were still just talking about Namibia. Look, I think Nico Lofty-Eaton, he scored the fastest 100. If that was the only thing that had happened for Namibia in that T20I series, I would still say pretty good job. I think Zane Green had a pretty good tour over the T20Is. Really showed that he can still contribute with a bat for Namibia. Not only that, but that he can do it down up or down the order. Again, they didn't make the final. By the end of it, I know that they had at least done the net run rate calculations, but they weren't looking to push to get into the final either. They were like, get the win first, and maybe if we're in a position where we can push past. Sorry for context. If for those of you at home who weren't running your net run rates spreadsheet, by the final Netherlands Namibia
What?
game in that series.
Who? I think everyone does that.
For context, for listeners who aren't sad sack weirdos who run net run rate spreadsheets for all the cricket that they watch, yeah, Namibia needed to win by about 30 runs in that last game against the Netherlands, and they were aware of that. But JJ said after the game, look, we were looking for the win. If there was a chance to get the net run rate boost as well, we might have gone for it, depending on the context of the game. But we just really were looking to win, which said to me that they weren't like desperate to play yet another game at the back end of their tour. Or at least ambivalent. And I don't think that you can judge too harshly what remained like quite a Namibia team without their captain and best player, and of course without David Visser, who's probably their second best player. Some will say still their best player. In a T20I series at the back end of a long tour, I don't think that you can judge them too harshly. And I also don't think they even did too badly if you look at the range of results.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously, Jan Nicol Lofty-Eaton, we can talk about that in a sec. JJ Smith with some dingers, I think he got a half century. Malan Kruger, who he's made a few appearances for Namibia back at home in some of their kind of, I think he played against maybe the Zimbabwe 11 or Uganda or one of those series. So he's sort of been in and around the team. So nice to see him coming in and contributing. He's also another keeping option. I'm not sure where Lohan Lawrence is. He wasn't in the ODI series, which is kind of his best format. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, Jan Nicol Lofty-Eaton. I mean, this I've been hyping Lofty-Eaton up for a couple of years now. Hopefully he can sort of continue the headspace that allows him to play these kinds of innings, the fastest T20I century ever. He has a kind of a manic Shahid Afridi energy where he's always trying to play five different shots to every ball, all of them going for six. I haven't seen him bowl a consistent patient spell when he rolls the arm over, but he's always trying to make something happen. He's great to watch. He's blockbuster. So I'm very excited to see him in the upcoming World Cup. I think he's got a huge amount of upside, but I don't know. Are you as high on Jan Nicol Lofty-Eaton as I am? I think we had a bit of a chat about him when he hit the knock.
Yeah, it's a great cricket to watch. And just, yeah, like, I think you're right. Like, he wants to change the game, whether he's got the bat or the ball in his hand. And just looking at that innings, it's not just that he's hit 100 off, you know, 30-odd balls. You know, that's the record that grabs the headlines. But if you look at the situation that Namibia were in when he came into bat...
coming in down the order.
He was coming in at number five. And I don't know if you have the scorecard in front of you and you can say what the score was when the wicket fell that brought him to the crease. But Namibia were in a hole, as I recall. And it looked, in fact, the whole series looked like it was just going to be the same as the ODIs. It was going to be very difficult to bat and you were going to get low-scoring scraps. And Lofty Eaton, that innings from him, it didn't just change the game. It almost changed the entire series. Just like, yeah, just the, like the intent, the just the ability to put the ball where he wants it, to have two options at least to play to every ball. And it just puts the fielding captain under so much pressure. It almost wasn't like he was taking on the bowling so much as that he was taking on Rohit Bawdal. Like just absolutely making a mockery of every field that was set to him. And yeah, I mean, it was phenomenal to watch. It was, of course, also the first game that I wasn't at live. It was regrettable, but it was phenomenal to watch at a bar in Pokhara on TV, which I had just convinced the guy to put the cricket on. So yeah, I mean, what an experience. Yeah, and it's great to see. The World Cup's going to be a step up for the whole side and for him as well, of course. And consistency is not something we've seen from him, but except for consistency in that, yeah, he looks like, you know, he always looks like he wants to take the game on. Great to see.
Yeah, hugely entertaining cricketer. And I mean, a pretty handy get for a lot of franchises, I would think. He can also keep wickets, so a lot of flexibility if you add him to the squad. But yeah, he came to the crease at 3 for 62 in 10.4 overs after Jan Frolink got out. And yeah, I mean, 3 for 62 and then to post 206, you know, they've basically scored 140 in 9 overs, which is a pretty handy run rate. Jan Frolink again, I think it's just a bit cute having him in the top of the order. They did that with Christy Villian a few years back. You know, when he was in the team, they put him in the top order a bit. And I kind of get the logic of it, but yeah, it didn't really work back then. And yeah, I'm still a bit skeptical of this approach. But moving on, you know, Netherlands ended up winning the tournament. Levitt piling on the runs, as you allude to. I think he hit almost 250 across 5 T20Is, including a century, which is always good. Engelbrecht also in the runs. He was the second top run scorer for the Netherlands, which is interesting because sort of, you know, you look at his technique, he seems more of a 50 over guy, but he was able to go up the gears. I think he was striking above 150 in the series as well. So he was very convincing.
Quite close to 160 at the end, yeah.
Hmm.
And yeah, you're right. He doesn't look the sort of bat to be doing that. He looks like a battler almost, really, like enormous sort of focus at the crease, but doesn't look like he enjoys it. but coming out of it, Levitt and Engelbrecht both averaged probably about 60. Levitt will have an obscenely high strike rate, probably closer to 200, given the 135 odd that he made. But Engelbrecht, who played a more consistent role, will also, yeah, has had a, just checking it now, he's had a strike rate close to, yeah, it's 158 was his strike rate, and an average of 57. And playing that role quite consistently. And I think that's, yeah, that is it's a huge asset to have him. I'm still not entirely convinced of him. He had very good return with his off spin. I'm still not entirely convinced that you need him as a frontline bowler, but it's a handy option to have. But I'm also not entirely convinced that number three is the best place to have him in the batting lineup either. But I'm very impressed with the fact that he can step up and do the job and do it very impressively. It's not the only job he can do with the bat. Just touching on the Dutch batting and roles, Tim van der Gugten showing finishing ability down the order. Great to have him back in the side, back in orange. And yeah, I think just the top order, I think you've got, let's not forget that there's more than a few players missing for the Dutch, of course, who have to fit back into this side somewhere. Colin Ackerman, you'd think would bat top four as well when he comes back to the World Cup. And then you have Logan van Beek down the order. And yeah, who knows, Tim Pringle possibly coming back into the side, Daniel Doran maybe coming into the side. And then, you know, the abs and fast bowlers as well, Paul van Meegen, I'm probably returning. So it's important for the Dutch, not just for the T20 World Cup, where the mix-up is going to be people pushing for to reclaim their spots in the side. But going forward, you're going to have different people absent for almost every series that the Dutch play, because you've got so many people playing around the world, and the game to be, I think, the Dutch squad, they want to kind of ration how much they try to pull players out of their professional setups with their counties or their provincial or their state sides. That you're going to have guys that can do a lot of different roles. And I think, yeah, SR, Engelbrecht, and Tim van der Lugt both have shown that they can do that.
Yeah, and you know, on the point about roles, I mean, we can, as we come to the end of this this review of the series, Nepal, the home side, they were in the final. They came pretty close, but they couldn't quite get over the line. T20, as I said, I think is their best format. They've got a, you know, rocket powered middle order with, you know, Mala, Airy, and Padel, all in the runs. The opening combo of Bertel and Sheikh, I really like, even though they didn't really score too many runs in the T20 series. The bowling, again, not super threatening, but again, it's kind of hard to judge on the road. But a lot of these guys are also able to roll the arm over for a few overs of spin bowling. So I think, you know, you talk about roles and flexibility. Nepal has a lot of flexibility in, you know, who they toss the ball to. There's just not really anyone that's going to be, you know, leading the attack in seam friendly conditions.
Oh yeah, I mean, the big strength that I see in this Nepal squad now, it's basically it's three names. It's the skipper, it's Rohit Pauwdel, it's Kushal Mallya, and above all, it's DS Airy. Because there's three players, they can win games with you the bat, and they can win games with you the ball now. Like the fact that Pauwdel just genuinely looks like a proper spinner now. Airy, we know what he can do. Kushal Mallya, like, what extraordinary talent. And they've got these three quality all-rounders, all of whom I think undoubtedly would be holding a place in the side with bat or ball. Well, maybe Pauwdel, he doesn't have quite the track record yet. But on the basis of this series, you would say that these guys are just three genuine all-rounders. And that gives you an enormous amount of flexibility. But of course, having that flexibility means it gives you an awful lot of choices, and you have to make the right ones. And I know that Monty Desai was constantly fielding off questions from a very active and opinionated Nepali press corps, questioning whether he made the right ones. And I think the more options you have, of course, the more chances you have to make the wrong decisions and make the wrong calls. And yeah, I think that you didn't see, so like Raj Banji, I think only played one of the games in the series. And just, yeah, looking at the seam options, the only consistent name, of course, is Kami. Karen played all the games, but I think at this stage, you need to be looking at other options in certain conditions. Avinash Bahara has been a long-term sort of death specialist for them. Didn't, well, I mean, just had a terrible, let's be honest, just had a very poor series. Lost in the end, like the final, that was really where they needed him to come through, and he couldn't. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't have the talent to do it. And it doesn't mean that they're not going to be keeping faith with him and looking for someone to execute that role going forward. But silver lining, I thought Pratish GC impressed with the ball over the course of the series. There are options coming through with potential. But yeah, I think it's a long-term question for Nepal going forward. Like, where are your star fast bowlers of the future coming from? Is that pipeline really where you want it to be? Is it producing the kind of bowlers that you need to eventually, you know, replace Sompal and Karen going forward? And yeah, at the World Cup, I think it is also a question. I think that people will be looking at the Nepali pace lineup as something of as yeah as an arguable weak point in the squad.
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to be something that opposing teams, you know, especially sort of higher ranked teams, will be targeting in the group play. We don't know necessarily what the decks are going to look like. So, I mean, if they end up being some of those, you know, some of those Caribbean and even US pitches in the past have been kind of low and slow and not really helping the fast bowlers. So potentially that could play to Nepal's strengths with, you know, with their flotilla of spin bowlers. But you know, if that's not the case, then I think, yeah, the seam attack especially is going to be coming in for a lot of stick against better batting lineups. Yeah, I mean, I guess who do you think is probably going to do the best out of the three teams here at the World Cup? I think, you know, Netherlands, my sense is that they have probably the highest ceiling in terms of, you know, being able to get past full members, but also, you know, they could very easily lose to Nepal in their group play.
You've got four games, and to get out of your group, you realistically you're going to need to win. At the very yeah, realistically, it's likely you'll need to win three of them, or two of them very convincingly, and that means that the opening game for the Netherlands and Nepal against each other is essentially it's almost sort of a de facto knockout already, because if you don't win that, then you're looking at having to knock over, at the very least, you have to knock over two or three, four members. You know, there's only two teams from each group of five advancing to the next stage, so there's a substantial cull. And yeah, that it essentially means not only that there's an expectation that four members will miss out, but also that any of the associates getting through will be news. So default, the expectation, of course, for any of the three sides is that, you know, a good result is to beat the other associates in your group, maybe pick off a full member and then go out of the group stage. That's still a passing grade. I think in terms of like the possibility that anyone can get through, I think any of these three teams, in theory, could have a good run through the group stage and get through to the Super Eights, but it would be a remarkable achievement. But I think I agree with you. I think if any of them are to get through to the Super Eights and perform at that level, I think at this stage still it is the Dutch that do have the highest ceiling in that regard. So the Dutch and for the Dutch and the Nepalese, I think you're looking at win your opening game, go from there. Don't lose your opening game, because otherwise it's essentially almost curtains for your World Cup. Namibia, the group that they have, they could very, you could, of course, you could see them picking up two wins. Scotland have looked out of sorts. Oman are entirely, you know, Namibia will be looking at that as an entirely winnable game. But in a group with England and Australia, it would still take the biggest win in their history to get them through the group stage. I do think, if I'm remembering right, they do play Australia and England last. So it's in theory they could be one of the teams that stay alive the longest. If they do pick up those wins against Oman and Scotland, those are entirely winnable games. But yeah, I mean the nature of the format is such that yeah, that a passing grade for any of these teams would be a couple of wins. But making it through to the Super Eight, you just yeah, it's a huge ask, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you look at the two groups that the, you know, that these three teams are in. In some ways, Namibia, I mean, they've only got two full members, so they've got two very winnable games against Scotland and Oman, and then two very difficult games against England and Australia, who are both, you know, two of the top white ball teams in the world at the moment. Although, I mean, maybe that's questionable given England's World Cup performance. But you know, Netherlands, they're in a group with Sri Lanka, South Africa, Bangladesh, and Nepal. They've beaten Bangladesh and South Africa at the last, you know, at the last ICC event they played at. And you know, I don't think Sri Lanka has any fear factor for the Netherlands. I think the Netherlands probably should have beaten Sri Lanka when they did play at the World Cup qualifier. And you know, Wesley Baresi was smashing them around.
That's been the one instance, I think, to be fair, where the Dutch have looked like they could compete against Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is something. If you look at the record of Sri Lanka against the Netherlands in white ball format,
That's true, actually. Previous
it
to
is a
2015.
history of curb stompings. like when the Netherlands, on the occasions that they do lose hard to full members, they normally pick the game against Sri Lanka to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But the more your broader point is well taken, I think, which is that while the because you've got three full members there, that you've got that the Dutch and Nepal's group has been labelled the group of death. And if I think you look at the average quality of the teams, that's not unreasonable, especially considering the fact, of course, that the Dutch were, in spite of reaching the second stage of the World Cup last time, sorry, were stripped of essentially their seeding for this World Cup, that it was done on rankings rather than on qualification, which is how you ended up with what is on paper what people have been calling the group of death. But your broader point is, I think, correct, which is group of death it may be, but there's a lot of teams there that can beat each other, which means there's way more of an obvious path through the group to qualifying for both the Dutch and for Nepal, I think, than for I think Namibia and Scotland, who you could sort of go like even if you have an upset over say England or Australia, the chances of you making it out of that group with England and Australia in it would almost take more than just upsetting one of those teams and then winning both your group games, then you're still only probably likely in with a 50-50 shot of making it through. So yeah, it's actually group of death it may be for the Netherlands and Nepal, because there's no soft games there. But it's actually, I think, by distance, the easier group to actually get out of.
Yep, will be very interesting to keep an eye on that as the World Cup gets underway in June. Not too long away, as we're slowly making our way through 2024 already. Thanks a lot for joining us, Bertus de Jong, to run through the Tri Series in Nepal and some very exciting cricket. And always great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Nick. Pleasure as ever.